From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. A soldier's life isn't an easy one. It can be even harder when that soldier is a woman fighting sexism within the ranks. On this edition of Fresh Air, we talk with Carol Barkalow. She was one of the first female cadets to attend West Point, and she's gone on to be a career officer in the Pentagon. Also today, we meet film producer Ed Pressman. His credits include Reversal of Fortune, Wall Street, Badlands, and Conan the Barbarian. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new collection of vintage Mingus recordings, over 14 hours of Mingus sessions from the 50s. And book critic John Leonard reviews the latest book from writer in hiding, Salman Rushdie. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. One of the key witnesses in the Keating Five savings and loan case was questioned today before the Senate Ethics Committee. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Edwin Gray, the head of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board during the Reagan administration, is the man who has accused the Keating Five of applying improper pressure on him and other SNL examiners on behalf of Charles Keating, the owner of the Lincoln Savings and Loan. All five senators received large campaign contributions from Keating, and the Ethics Committee is trying to determine whether those contributions were connected with the senator's intervention and whether that intervention violated Senate rules. Today, under questioning from the committee's special counsel, Robert Bennett, Gray described the meeting that he was asked to attend with four of the five senators. The fifth, Donald Riegel of Michigan, attended only the second meeting with San Francisco bank examiners 1 week later. Gray said he felt pressured and intimidated as the senators asked him to withdraw a banking regulation that would limit some of Lincoln's riskier investments. Gray will be cross-examined by attorneys for the five senators and members of the Ethics Committee. His testimony is expected to continue tomorrow. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
A federal appeals court has refused to reinstate the three-count criminal conviction of former White House aide Oliver North. North's convictions in the Iran-Contra affair were set aside in July. The appeals court refused to rehear the case, meaning that the original judge must hold a hearing to determine if North's trial was tainted by immunized testimony that North gave to Congress. North was convicted of helping to prepare a false chronology of the Iran-Contra affair for Congress, altering or destroying National Security Council documents, and accepting an illegal gratuity. John Major, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, has won the contest for leadership of the Conservative Party and will become Great Britain's new Prime Minister tomorrow. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from London.
The 47-year-old Major fell just two votes short of outright victory in today's second round of voting for the Tory leadership. Minutes after the results were made public, his two rivals, Michael Heseltine and Douglas Hurd, announced that they would throw their support to Major in the interests of party unity. Major received 185 out of the 372 votes of the Tory members of Parliament. Michael Heseltine, the former defense secretary, polled a disappointing 131, and the foreign secretary, Douglas Hurd, a distant third with 56 votes. John Major, the candidate with the least experience, was Margaret Thatcher's personal favorite to succeed her. He is viewed as most likely to carry on her policies. Tomorrow, he will become the youngest British prime minister this century. I'm Mike Schuster in London.
Stock prices posted a modest gain today on Wall Street after seesawing up and down in reaction to falling and rising oil prices. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained almost 11 points to close at 2,543.81. Advances led declines by a margin of 2-1 in moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As American troops have gone off to the Gulf, we've watched women soldiers kiss goodbye their husbands and children, something the American public probably hasn't gotten used to yet. Captain Carol Barkalow isn't shipping off to the Gulf. She works in the Pentagon as a special assistant to the Chief of Staff of the Army. But she's among the women who have stood up for the equal rights of women in the military. Barkalow was in the first group of women admitted to West Point. She graduated in 1980. She served in West Germany for a year at a nuclear missile site, then returned to the States and took command of a truck company at Fort Lee, Virginia. She's written about her Army experiences in her new book, In the Men's House. I asked Barkalow to explain the current law affecting women in combat.
Well, the law prohibits women in the Air Force and the Navy from flying fighters and being on combatant ships. In the Army, there is only what's called a combat exclusion policy. There is no law that prohibits women in the Army from direct combat. Right now, over in the Gulf, women are serving in all kinds of combat support and combat service support jobs. They are in military intelligence units. They're in signal units. They're in supply and transport units. You name it, they're over there in any kind of support situation.
Does this mean if there is a war, women are likely to fight in combat in the Army?
Yes, they are. I think they are. Right now, we do not fight in direct offensive combat. Everyone in the Army has the right of self-defense. Everyone in the Army has been trained with the M16 rifle. So, and everyone carries either the M16 rifle or a handgun or something with a larger caliber.
Do you think that women should be excluded from combat positions in parts of the military?
No, I don't. My feeling, my belief is that the best person for the job is the one that should get the job. And I think that's what we need. We need the strength in our military, and it's strength not just in terms of physical strength, but we also need that mental and emotional strength. And I think that women are just as capable as men in all those areas.
What would be the probability of your ending up serving in the Gulf?
Well, right now, not much. And, in the military, everybody has to do their desk time, you might say. I've been out in a unit for seven years. And now it's time for me to sit behind a desk for a little while. Most of us try to keep that to a minimum, but because of the types of jobs, we all do our part. And, those people who are... those of us who work in the Pentagon, we do a lot to support Desert Shield. And, I think I'll have my turn. Next summer, it looks like I'll be going out to a school in Kansas for 10 months. And after that, I will be out to a unit, to a line unit. And if we're still over there in the Gulf, I'm sure I'll get my chance.
Would you want to be in the Gulf?
You know, I think I would. And
you,
I don't.
You would or would not?
I would. Uh-huh. I don't want to go to war. And I don't think you'll find too many people in the military who want to go to war. I feel that I'm in the Army to keep peace, not to wage war. And I think that deterrence works. But this is what I've been trained for. This is what we've all been trained for. And I feel very confident at the level of training I've received that if something does happen, I feel confident that I can accomplish the mission assigned to me.
Tell me why you joined West Point back in 1976.
Well, at 16... I decided I wanted to be an officer in the Army. It was the summer before my senior year in high school. And I had grown up a tomboy. I had three older brothers, and I was the first girl after three boys. And I had been a tomboy. I'd always been involved in athletics. I played basketball. I played field hockey. I ran track. I enjoyed being physical. And the physicalness of the Army appealed to me. I also felt what it was like to be part of a team. I really enjoyed being around people. I really enjoyed the discipline of athletics. And for me, I thought that the Army would be a natural extension to that. I actually applied for an ROTC scholarship, thinking I would go to a regular college, and then after the 4 years, I would be commissioned in the regular Army. And I applied for an ROTC scholarship, but as it turned out, I didn't get the ROTC scholarship, but West Point accepted me. So, being a fatalist, I believe that West Point was where I was supposed to be.
Did you face a lot of resentment or hostility from male cadets when you joined West Point?
Well, as a first-year cadet, as a plebe, we have what's called a fourth-class system. And every fourth-class cadet, every plebe, is stressed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for that whole year. So at times, it was hard to determine whether you were being hazed because you were a woman or because you were a plebe. Now, there definitely were some who made it known, who made it very obvious that they didn't want women at the academy. And that was a vocal minority. But the problem was it was vocal. So it seemed like there was so much more resentment, so much more animosity to us being there.
What are some of the things women would be subjected to that male cadets weren't?
Well, one of the things we had to do as a plebe was to greet upperclassmen every time we'd go by them. You know, and you'd greet them saying, good morning, sir, good afternoon, sir. And those who would show their distaste might come back with good morning, bitch, or it was a good place until you got here, whore. Comments like that. So you knew where the guy was coming from. They didn't pull any punches there.
In your book, you write, if we were not socializing heavily with male cadets, then it meant we were lesbians. If we were socializing with male cadets, it meant we were whores. So what were you expected to do socially?
Well, see, here's the problem. I think there's been such a stereotype for such a long time about women. You know, we're either one or the other. And I think the attitude was still there at West Point when we got there. Because, you know, what kind of woman would want to go to West Point? I mean, the people couldn't understand. But I think after we were there for a while, and it's much better today, people understand that we went for the same reasons that men went. We wanted to have a career. We wanted to have something challenging. It was difficult there to socialize because we were in a fishbowl. So every move we made, someone was watching. It was difficult, and it was a tough place to grow up socially.
What were the regulations about socializing between men and women?
The first year, you could not date, could not fraternize. And this was men and women and men, because we could not be recognized as plebes by the upperclassmen. We could not be called by our first name. So that prohibited any kind of dating between males and females. And it was supposed to have prohibited, you know, the male friendship, between the upper-class males and the plebe males. After that, after we became upperclassmen, we could not date anyone in our chain of command. If I was in, and in fact, I talk about it in the men's house, I tried to stop a relationship because Mike Truxell, when I was a sophomore, he was a senior, he was my company commander. And I tried to be the one to stop it because it was against regulations, and he didn't like that. So I guess I paid for it during plebe year because I did fraternize, and I got in trouble, and then I paid for it again when I was a yearling, a second-year cadet.
How did you pay for it that time?
I had to walk the area again. He would find different things. My room would be dirty. He would talk to the officer in charge of our company, and the officer in charge of our company was the one who handed out any slugs, and slugs being demerits and hours on the area. And anything that Mike could get me on, he got me on, and I ended up walking a number of hours on the area because he was not happy with me breaking off our relationship.
Gays and lesbians are still not allowed to serve in the military. Was there a lot of fear about showing a lot of warmth to women friends, fear that you'd be thought of as a lesbian and your career would be at stake, you might get expelled?
Well, it was tough in the beginning for women to be grouped together. In the beginning, what we wanted to do was just assimilate. We wanted to be part of the core. And many times that first year, and even sometimes that second year, it meant staying away from your other female classmates and just trying to bond with the men. I think that we got over that the last 2 years we were there. Sometimes people still think about that today. Sometimes it's tough because women are still only a small percentage of the force. We still stand out. We are still different. And I try not to think like that because, I know myself and I know the other women officers that I may associate with. And so we try to keep ourselves above, being our own worst enemy because of that.
Mm-hmm. Now, your commanders were all men, I imagine. Was everybody in your chain of command male?
Yes.
What was, if anything, especially difficult about that? Were there things that you felt the men didn't understand about women, or was there anything they were very self-conscious about suddenly having to command women for the first time?
Well, I think that, I think the issue of women and being used to women in the Army is generational. Many of the officers who are maybe, at this point, 20 years my senior, in their early 50s, never had the opportunity, and even in the late 40s, I have to say, never had the opportunity to work with women. They've only seen women as their mother, you know, their wife, their daughter, or their girlfriend. So they don't know what it feels like to work with a woman as a peer or have a woman work for them. So each time I had, you know, reported in, gotten a new commander, or had to work with another male who had never worked with women, I always made sure it was their adjustment to me, not mine to them. Most of the time, and I still think this is true today, when a man reports to a unit, when a male officer reports to a unit, he's usually thought of as strong until proven weak. But when a female officer reports to a unit, I think she's still usually thought of as weak until she proves herself strong. So we are still proving ourselves, and I think that that's going to be the case probably for the next generation.
Mm-hmm. At West Point, was the physical regimen for women different than men?
Not really. There were differences, and there are differences in standards. Physiologically, you know, it doesn't take a brain surgeon to see that there are differences between men and women. But our standards were adjusted so that I would physically exert the same amount of force to run the 2 miles as a man would. The times would be adjusted. But over the last 14 years, the differences between men and women for time, say in the 2 mile run, have decreased. And I also think that's generational, because young women today are finding out that it's okay at an early age to lift weights. It's okay to be physical. And as our generations evolve to that, I honestly believe our physiological differences will decrease to the point where it doesn't matter, because you will always have a Max and you will always have a Min. During the first summer, we carried M16 rifles, which were about 7 pounds, and the men carried M14 rifles, which were about 10, 11 pounds for the runs. And that's it. Every time else, we carried the M14. When we were on a parade, when we walked the area, we carried the M14 rifle.
You describe in your book how a lot of the male cadets would tell female cadet jokes.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually West Point instituted a penalty against the telling of such jokes. What kind of jokes were going around, and what finally was the penalty against telling them?
Okay, well, I'll tell one B-net joke.
Okay.
Okay. And the difference, and a B-net is a female plebe. They called plebes beans, beanheads, and they called the women B-nets. And the one B-net joke was, what's the difference between an elephant and a B-net? And the answer is about 5 pounds, but you can force feed the elephant to make up the difference. You know, so there were a lot of weight jokes.
Why were there weight jokes?
Well, we were being fed between 4,000 and 5,000 calories a day. And it was tough when your metabolism is much slower than a man's, because that's, you know, what the nutrition was geared for, was for a man. We didn't lose the weight, burn up the weight, burn up the food like men did. It took West Point a number of years to finally get a nutritionist in there for all the cadets to eat healthier. A lot of us, you know, myself, I was thick there. That's what I call it. About 155 pounds, probably at the most I weighed there. And I knew I was thick. And now I'm much thinner and feel much better.
So what was the penalty against telling?
Okay, well, the penalty for pretty much anybody being unprofessional, you know, and that's really what it comes down to. You expect cadets, you expect officers to be professional. And telling these jokes was truly unprofessional and shouldn't have been tolerated. And in time, it wasn't tolerated. And the cadet would probably get slugged, figuratively, not literally, and walk hours on the area. Or if it was bad enough, they would be released from the academy, thrown out.
Now, you once tried to walk out of a sexual awareness class.
Mm-hmm.
What offended you?
The way that
my fellow cadets reacted. I was amazed at how conservative and sometimes how close-minded some of my male classmates were. And I think overall the type of male cadet that attends West Point is culturally and politically conservative, whereas the type of woman who attends the academy probably is politically conservative but culturally liberal. So there is a difference, and I guess I couldn't understand that. I felt like I had proven myself, but they couldn't look any further than that. People would say, "Oh, well, you're different," and I would say, "No, I'm not. Women have the capability," and I was just appalled at how close-minded they were.
My guest is Captain Carol Barkalow. She was among the first group of women to graduate from West Point, and she's just written a memoir about her experiences in the Army called In the Men's House. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Carol Barkalow is my guest, author of a new book about her Army experiences called In the Men's House. How do you think West Point has changed for women since you were there? You were, after all, in the first class of women.
Well, I think it's gotten a lot better. I don't think that sexual harassment was tolerated like it was when I was there. And I think that the reason it was tolerated so much when I was there is because the administration didn't know really what was going on. And I talk about the one incident in the men's house where I think the academy woke up when a classmate of mine was physically harassed. And she ended up leaving the academy.
This was in the middle of the night. A man snuck into her room
and
sexually abused her.
That's correct. And I think at that point, and it's sad to say that we needed an incident like that, but after that, the academy woke up and became much more sensitive to our needs and what we were going through. And I think it's much better today. It is not tolerated, and people know that. Now, there is, I'm sure, still some dissension among the Corps. There are going to be those diehards forever. But it is a small, small minority, and we've come a long way in 14 years.
You commanded a transport company in Fort Lee, Virginia.
Right.
And had mostly men under your command.
Mm-hmm.
Was there resistance to you as a woman?
No. I think some people thought that there would be. My NCOs, my senior enlisted soldiers, my non-commissioned officers, for the most part wanted to know if I was going to be there for them, if I was going to stick up for them, if I was going to take care of them and accomplish the mission. And I think it didn't even take a month for them to realize that I was very serious about taking care of them and accomplishing our mission.
Do you think it's harder for career military women to have a social life than it is for their male counterparts?
Yeah, I do. And I can tell you that from experience. I honestly do. Because it's not normal for military women to date civilian guys. We do a lot of dating within the service. In fact, a classmate of mine ended a 5-year engagement with a civilian because he finally realized that she was very serious about her career and that she wanted, her aspiration, her goal was to be a battalion commander, which happens at about probably the 18 to 20 year mark. And she would have to do those things to punch that ticket to get there. And he wasn't willing to follow her or even stand by her. So at times it's been very lonely for me in the military. But I guess, you weigh the good and the bad. And, I have to say that I'm very, very glad to be where I'm at today.
Are you getting any flack within the military for writing a book that is reasonably critical of how parts of the military have treated women?
From the Army itself, I guess you could say, as an institution, no. And in fact, they're very supportive. As you can see on the cover of the book, I appear in uniform. And I had to receive an exception to policy to do that because there is a regulation that states that I cannot use the uniform in a private endeavor. I also appear on a number of TV shows in uniform, and I had to get an exception to policy to do that. I think, you know, even though the Army knows that this is somewhat of a critical book, they also know that I'm still in the Army, I am successful so far, and, you know, I do believe that I owe the success I've achieved today to West Point in the Army. So I think it's a good story for the military.
And you think that's why they gave you the exception?
I think so. I mean, you know, to be quite honest, it does benefit the Army. If someone asked me, if a young woman, even a young man, asked me today, you know, should I join the military? I can tell them from my experience that it hasn't been all good, but overall, it's been a positive experience for me.
I think the position for anyone in the military changes at wartime or at a time when there's the possibility of war. There's a specific war, there's a specific conflict for which you would be asked to risk your life.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be a war that you may or may not consider a just war. And I see soldiers on the news every night on the way to Iraq saying, we'll go, we'll get the job done, and then we'll come home. And I'm wondering how someone like you, who have questioned military policy so much on the issue of women, if you feel that you could just accept orders without really thinking them through and challenging them.
Well, the thing I think I mentioned earlier, you know, I believe that deterrence works. And I fully understood when I raised my hand and when I became a second lieutenant that I would support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And I do take that to heart. I believe that, you know, send me, because I am competent, I am capable, I am well-trained. And we've got a couple hundred thousand soldiers over there who are well-trained. And, you know, I think that we will do the job if need be. And, I've questioned regulations. I have questioned orders before. But I have never been put into the situation, I have to say, where it's do or die.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Carol Barkalow has written a book about her experiences in the Army. It's called In the Men's House. Next time, jazz singer Betty Carter. Here's something from her new album, Droppin' Things. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Music, by the sake of music, satisfies my hunger and beauty. By the sake of beauty, pacifies my soul, yet I often get that wistful feeling. Sitting here beside you, for those things I love are you. And nothing more. I love music.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's called The Complete Debut Recordings of Charles Mingus, and it lives up to its name, 14 hours of music Mingus recorded back in the 50s. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews the new collection. Also, we talk about making and financing movies with producer Ed Pressman. Two of his new films are now showing, Reversal of Fortune and To Sleep with Anger. And John Leonard has a review of a new book written by Salman Rushdie while in hiding. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Cuba and Yemen have accused the UN Security Council of dragging its feet on the issue of protecting Palestinians in the Israeli-occupied territories. Some members of the UN Security Council fear discussion of the resolution could jeopardize Thursday's vote on whether to authorize military force against Iraq for its invasion of Kuwait. Jim Zeroli reports.
Cuba, Yemen, and Malaysia want the Security Council to take up a resolution that would broaden the UN's role in policing the occupied territories, something opposed by the Israeli government. But the resolution has been shelved in the past few weeks as the Council has debated the Persian Gulf crisis. Today, Yemen's ambassador indicated he may force a vote on the Israeli resolution, something that would probably provoke a U.S. veto. Such a move by the U.S. could alienate its Arab friends in the anti-Iraq coalition and jeopardize the voting on the military force resolution against Iraq on Thursday. But the U.S., which presides over the council this month, indicated it may try to block the Yemeni move on procedural grounds, averting a showdown. In New York, this is Jim Zeroli reporting.
The Soviet ambassador to the U.N. says Iraq will have until the 15th of January to pull its troops out of Kuwait before it faces the possibility of U.N.-authorized military action. Western diplomats say that Secretary of State Baker and Soviet Foreign Minister Shevardnadze fixed the deadline to be included in a proposed resolution during the last 24 hours. The date after which a military strike could begin had been the only unresolved issue in the draft measure. President Bush wound up a two-day visit to Mexico today with assurances from Mexican President Carlos Salinas that his country is committed to pursuing a free trade agreement. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Both leaders made it clear they want free trade between the two countries, but questions about job displacement, immigration, and what will and will not be covered must be answered in the negotiations ahead. President Bush was asked at a luncheon today by Mexican businessmen whether U.S. protectionism might jeopardize an agreement. His response was that U.S. exports are strong.
And I think most Americans realize that if we are going to export, we better not be protectionist. You can't have it both ways.
Bush administration officials met with their Mexican counterparts to discuss border violence, drug control, and environmental problems. There was not much talk about the Persian Gulf. However, in a speech this afternoon, President Salinas reaffirmed Mexico's support for U.S. military policy in the Gulf. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Monterrey, Mexico.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 10.5 points to close at 2,543.81. on volume of some 148 million shares. Trading today was moderate. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later on the show, I'll talk with film producer Ed Pressman about making his new movie, Reversal of Fortune. In the 1950s, drummer Max Roach and the late bassist Charles Mingus founded Debut Records. It was one of the first and more artistically successful musician-owned record labels. A new 12-CD box set brings together all the debut recordings on which Mingus appeared as leader or sideman. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it's an epic, literally.
Complete debut recordings of Charles Mingus, 14 hours of stuff recorded between 1951 and 57, is, like most epics, a long and complicated journey with a happy ending. There's lots of good stuff here, much of it never released before, Still, chances are it won't all grab you on first listening, the way the bassist's later stuff does. You have to get almost to the end of it before you hear the emergence of the mature Mingus, a musician who fused jazz, blues, gospel, and European classical music like nobody else. Mingus and Max Roach set up the debut label to give exposure to other players as well as themselves. Mingus stays in the background on many sessions, and they're not always by musicians of his own stature.
People all say I'm dopey or they think I'm crazy. Girls don't pull their hair out over me. But now since I've learned to make believe, I'm as happy as a guy can be. If you make believe with all the fine chicks, then you're sure to get some crazy way out kicks. You'll never care if they're putting you on, for you are the coolest when making believe.
That's Jackie Paris, one of several singers of dubious merit featured on debut, crooning a Mingus lyric. Of course it's not very good, but its off-the-wall excesses are typical of Mingus, one of jazz's true larger-than-life types. Besides, his failures tend to be more amusing than most people's. That lyric may be terrible, but it's pretty funny. Not all of the stuff here that's supposed to be bad is bad. Miles Davis did a four-song session for debut that critics have been knocking since it was recorded in 1955. The arrangements are a little fussy, but Miles's playing anticipates the melancholy ballads he'd specialize in later. Miles Davis isn't the only jazz superstar who turns up in this box. There is also a famous concert recording from Toronto with bebop giants Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Bud Powell, and Max Roach. But some of the best sessions are with players you probably haven't heard of, like pianist Spalding Givens, now known as Nadi Kumar. By the way, that's Max Roach on drums. Nadi Kumar's habit of working up jazz versions of classics like Rhapsody in Blue surely appealed to Mingus, who might insert a classical theme into one of his own performances. I'm sure you classical music fans recognize that as Rachmaninoff's Prelude in C-sharp minor, combined with Dizzy Gillespie's arrangement of All the Things You Are. Mingus called it All the Things You Can C-sharp. It comes from one of his last debut sessions, recorded under his leadership at New York's Café Bohemia. These live tracks were among the best things in the debut box, made even better because half of them have never been released before. In a sense, everything that's gone before it leads up to this session, which also looks ahead to the gospel-tinged music Mingus would make in the future. It contains the earliest versions of what would become a Mingus standard, his Haitian fight song. This collection as the story of a heroic quest. Giving other folks a hand helped Mingus discover his own direction. The Café Bohemia sessions aren't the last thing in the debut box, but they're its dramatic climax. Like all lavish box sets, this one is a budget buster, so let me recommend a couple of inexpensive LPs as an alternative. a debut sampler called Autobiography in Jazz, and the album Mingus Live at the Bohemia are in Fantasy Records' Original Jazz Classics series. If after listening to those you still want the box set but can't afford it, well, you can always write a letter to Santa Claus.
Kevin Whitehead is a frequent contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Charles Mingus, the complete debut recordings, distributed by Fantasy Records. This is Fresh Air. American Film Magazine recently named my guest Ed Pressman Producer of the Decade, and he's the only living film producer ever honored with a retrospective of his work at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Pressman is known for taking chances on new directors. He produced Oliver Stone's first film, The Hand, and has since worked with him on Wall Street and talk radio. He brought Terrence Malick's first feature to the screen, the critically acclaimed Badlands, and David Byrne's True Stories. He worked with Arnold Schwarzenegger on Conan the Barbarian and with Sylvester Stallone on Paradise Alley. And he oversaw the Alex Cox fiasco, Walker. Pressman produced three films that are currently showing in theaters, Reversal of Fortune, To Sleep with Anger, and Waiting for the Light. Reversal of Fortune is a film about Klaus von Bülow, who was found not guilty of attempting to murder his wife, Sunny, who is still in a coma. It was directed by Barbe Schroeder and based on a book by Alan Dershowitz, who was von Bülow's lawyer. Pressman told me how he ended up making the Dershowitz book into a film.
Ilan Dershowitz, Alan's son, was a young postgraduate looking to get into the film business and took like a entry-level job with my company to be my driver, which is usually a film student's kind of job. And he was working with me for, I guess, about 9 months. And I really didn't know who his father was or much about him or much about the von Bülow case, except what I read in the papers sort of vaguely. He showed me a manuscript of Reversal of Fortune, the book that his father was had written, just for advice on what I thought might be done with it, and I responded to it immediately as something that I thought could be a film.
Were you ever concerned that having Alan Dershowitz as a co-producer, that it might become something, that there might be a lot of pressure on you to show Dershowitz in a good light, you know, because you had the son of the main character in the movie, co-producing the movie with you, and of course his father is a really high-powered lawyer, and knows how to get his way on things.
Well, I think that if I thought that we weren't going to be able to operate with the kind of freedom that was necessary, I wouldn't have gotten involved. I believed, and it turned out to be the case, that Ilan understood very clearly the kind of freedom that we needed. He was open-minded. He's very aware of his father's foibles and the kind of criticism he sometimes provokes. I think Barbe, when he started, was very concerned, as he suggested, that it could inhibit him. And he was wary and kept Ilan out of the meetings for a while. Slowly, Ilan gained their confidence, and he was welcomed as a very valuable contributor, and it wasn't a problem.
As a producer, I'm sure you do a lot of your work on the telephone. To give us a sense of what your day-to-day job is like, what were some of the phone calls you got and you made today?
Let's see, I was on the phone with Ken Lipper, who's a Wall Street fellow, a friend who was our advisor on Wall Street, the movie, who we're working with on a project about mayoral politics. Ken was a deputy mayor of New York, and we're working with Nick Pileggi and Paul Schrader on a script. I talked to Paul Schrader about that because Nick and Paul and Ken had a meeting over the weekend while I was away on Thanksgiving holiday, and they were both reporting about their meeting, so we had several discussions about that. I talked to John Shirley, who's a writer about a project he and Bill Gibson have written called Macrochip, a kind of cyberpunk screenplay. I had sent John Shirley a screenplay that I had called Stars, My Destination, an Alfred Bester book. And since Shirley's a science fiction fanatic, I thought I'd get his opinion of the script that we had. Talked to Goldwyn Company about To Sleep With Anger over the weekend. Discussed the kind of ads that might be put in the paper this coming week.
Well, let me stop you there. You're mentioning the ads for To Sleep With Anger. This has been pretty controversial lately. There's a lot of... some people feel that the marketing campaign hasn't been good enough toward potential black viewers. This is a film by Charles Burnett about a black extended family, a middle-class family in Los Angeles. The grandparents are from the South, and a wayward old friend from the South comes to visit and brings with him violence and a disregard for work and family. The film hasn't been doing very well commercially, and there's been many more white than black viewers going. And some people think it's because the advertising campaign hasn't really been geared to a black audience. So what do you think? You produced the movie.
Opening the film, we had a very limited amount of money to advertise the film based on the way the whole thing was financed, which was very difficult in the first place. And a good amount of it was spent trying to open the film as a much more wide kind of release in Atlanta and a couple of other cities where a lot of television was bought and radio. And because Danny Glover was in it, there was a feeling that maybe the film would play to that kind of wide audience that many of his films have attracted. And it didn't work. It didn't play to the middle-class audience, white or black. And what we came to see was that it was really a film that had to be platformed very carefully to a sophisticated audience, as I said, black or white, and allow the film to build. Unfortunately, we'd spent so much of the money that we had on the tests in the first markets that we really haven't had a lot left to keep it alive. But fortunately, it seems to be growing. The general results this week are up over last week, and that's unusual.
The Japanese audio company Matsushita, manufacturers of Panasonic, Quasar, and Technics, just bought MCA. What do you think that's going to mean for the movie business?
Well, I think it's will basically reinforce the strength of MCA as Sony's investment reinforced the strength of Columbia, and generally continues the concentration of power among a very few very strong companies, the major studios. And I think the companies that are sort of middle-sized companies like Orion or MGM now are the ones that suffer, because these are companies that are competing directly with the majors and they don't have the financial strength that a company like Matsushita can bring to it.
I think for
independent companies like ours, I think it's actually potentially a very good thing.
Why?
Because these big companies, they need software, and they cannot provide it all themselves, so they've become almost umbrella-like companies. And many independent companies have now aligned themselves with the studios, companies like Morgan Creek and Imagine and Largo, and there are many independent companies that now distribute films through major studios. In the old days, that was a very rare thing. The old Goldwyn Company or Selznick Company produced some great movies, but they were very few in terms of numbers and influence on the general distribution pattern. It was really very limited. The independent companies that distribute through majors are now much more important. They probably supply close to half of the films being made now.
A lot of directors talk about how their movie ended up being subjected to a focus group who kind of voted on the kind of ending that they wanted, and then the director had to change the ending of the movie if the end of the movie didn't play very well to the focus group. Do you ever do that with movies you've produced? Do a screening and see what the response is and alter the movie to get a better response?
It really depends on the director. Some directors really welcome that opportunity. Some directors, you know, Oliver Stone for one, don't want to hear about it.
What's a movie that you've tested and changed? Is there one?
We tried different endings with Barbe Schroeder's, you know, complicity on Reversal.
Mm-hmm.
And the very end of the film, I don't know if you saw it.
I did.
Jeremy Irons in the drugstore.
Yeah.
Was something that we weren't sure if it was, you know, too cute or if it would work. And it when we tested it, we saw clearly that it was an effective way to end the movie.
What are your greatest frustrations in the movie business?
Well, sometimes, you know, making a film that you spend so long on and believe in so much and seeing it, you know, disappear in no time. We just did a film called Waiting for the Light with a young Welsh filmmaker, Chris Munger, with Shirley MacLaine and Terry Garr. And I thought it was a lovely film, which had been very well received in England and Canada. And the critics here really didn't like it. And the film was gone in 2 weeks. And that's frustrating.
So what happens then? Does the film go to video?
Yeah, sure.
So that's a help. I mean, the film doesn't die altogether.
Right.
Did you ever give up on a film yourself? Did you ever say, God, I know this isn't going to play. It didn't turn out the way I wanted it to. I'm going to cut out now, cut my losses.
No, it's hard enough to get films made without getting into things that you don't believe in. I think that I always believe that the films we're doing, you know, are wonderful and are going to be very popular, and I've never lost that confidence in the process of doing a film.
Ed Pressman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Ed Pressman produced the films Reversal of Fortune and To Sleep with Anger. Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what do you have on the new Prime Minister of England?
Hi, Terry. His name is John Major. He was the favorite of Margaret Thatcher to become the new leader of the Conservative Party and therefore the new Prime Minister of Britain. In the voting, he was short of a majority by a few votes, but the other candidates, Michael Heseltine and Douglas Hurd, conceded the election. John Major will become Prime Minister at 9:45 a.m. tomorrow morning, 5 minutes after Margaret Thatcher's official resignation. Also, President Bush in Mexico talking with the president there about free trade between the two countries, and a report from Washington State about the flooding. A lot of blame being put on real estate development. Too much water, too much asphalt.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. It's been close to 2 years since the publication of Salman Rushdie's novel, The Satanic Verses. But the Ayatollah Khomeini's death sentence against Rushdie, which sent him into hiding, remains in effect. But Rushdie keeps writing, and John Leonard has a review of his new book.
Rushdie, of course, is still in hiding, under sentence of death. And so his new book, Haroon, which is a children's story that adults can listen in on, will be read for auguries and double meanings and hidden agendas and Freudian slips. And Rushdie, being Rushdie, the cleverest of writers, conspires at these decodings. But Haroon is also lovely in its own right. And before I do some messy deconstructing, I should say so. Rashid, a storyteller, and Haroon, his son, have been deserted by their wife and mother. Haroon wants to know what's the use of stories that aren't even true. His sorrowful father falls silent. And so the loving and guilt-stricken son embarks on a dream journey to the wonderland where all stories come from. As in any delightful children's story, there he will consort with fabulous beasts who play games with logic and language. He will be brave and perplexed and save the ocean of stories from pollution and bring back speech to his father and his mother for himself. This wonderland is called Kahani, which means story in Hindustani. To get to it, Haroon must cross all of Alif Bay, which means alphabet, from the town of G to the valley of K through the pass of H and a tunnel of I, assisted by characters called If and But, Haroon at last arrives on Earth's second moon, divided into day and night. The children of light, called guppies, are custodians of stories. Their parliament is called a chatterbox. Instead of an army, they have a library. Instead of soldiers, pages. The children of darkness, called chuppies, worship the idol of Bezaban, which means tongueless. They're enslaved to Khatum Shud, which means finished or shut up. He is the prince of silence, archenemy of all stories, and sews up their lips with twine. Naturally, Gup and Chup go to war, involving water genies, shadow warriors, griffins, manticores, trolls, and a heroic young female page called Blabbermouth. That's all I'm going to tell you, except that Haroon learns that by naming, we create being, and that the world is full of things he hasn't seen but should nevertheless believe in, like Africa, submarines, kangaroos, pagodas, and the North Pole, not to mention the future and the past. Now, Western readers will see the Brothers Grimm, Gulliver's Travels, Alice in Wonderland, The Wizard of Oz, The Phantom Tollbooth, and Star Wars. Eastern readers know perfectly well that Rashid and Haroon are out of the Arabian Nights, that Dull Lake is borrowed from the legendary Dal Lake and its floating gardens, that the ocean of stories belongs originally to an 11th century Hindu epic from which the Ramayana also derives. Geopoliticians will have no trouble spotting the Ayatollah, and a parable of popular democracy. Heavyweight literary critics will likewise find a parable of postmodernism. Silence, Rushdie is saying, has its own grace and beauty. Gup needs Chup as an existential other. We all have our dark side. Why else would a stuttering shadow warrior struggle to articulate Gogogol and Kafkafka? And then there's Marianne Wiggins, the wife who left Rushdie after he'd gone into hiding. But personally, I'm just astonished. I'd have thought Rushdie in exile would wither, that each time he looked out his window, all he'd see was bloody rain. Instead, from his own moon, he's brought back butterflies and jokes. He's a better man and braver than most of us could hope for ourselves.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Haroon by Salman Rushdie. Our interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers and Amy Sallet, with production assistance from Joan Tuohy, Roberta Shurrock, and Sue Spolin, and research assistance from Dan Buskirk and Lisa Bocchini. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet one of the best singers in jazz, Betty Carter. And Roger Fisher, director of the Harvard Negotiation Project, tells us how we can negotiate our way out of the Gulf crisis. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Forecast for tonight, partly cloudy, patchy fog developing, an overnight low of 47 degrees.